People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, something so bad happens that a terrible sadness is carried with it, and the soul can't rest. Then sometimes, just sometimes, the crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's The Crow Retrospective Series.
You have no idea what hell awaits you.
Hosted by Stuart.
All must love you.
Arnie.
I feel that you are quite brilliant and broken.
And Jacob.
Didn't we kill that guy?
This episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Word of the wise, watch your fucking mouth.
We hope you enjoy the show.
It can't rain all the time.
Today we're discussing The Crow, starring Bill Skarsgård, FKA Twigs, and Danny Houston, directed by Rupert Sanders. This is your brilliantly broken co-host of Now Playing, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the co-host with the look of someone who hates everything inside of him. Though that look is dependent on what movie I've just seen, so we'll see. This is Jacob.
So welcome to the remake of The Crow. Long delayed, even more gestating. I watched some interviews with James O'Barr. He's been doing Comic-Cons lately, and he had been approached back in 2009 to advise on a remake of The Crow. Or they're not calling this a remake. Apparently, the PR people at Lionsgate get really angry if you call this a remake. It's just a new adaptation of the source material.
Yeah, basically, they have to tread lightly on the grave of Brandon Lee and not offend any of the people who love that original movie and see any attempt to continue this franchise as a betrayal of his legacy.
And I thought you're like memeing us, Stuart, but man, when images of this first came out, I realized, wow, there is a very fanatic Crow community out there that is going to pull this apart just like any Star Wars fan or Marvel fan might.
That had to be why it took so long. Because, I mean, everything's been rebooted. I mean, if the 21st century has been about anything, it's about redoing the 20th century, at least in terms of movies. And I would have figured we would have had this Crow reboot, 4 or 5 years. No one even remembers the Edward Furlong thing or saw it. So, yeah, 2009 feels like when this should have happened. And yet here we are, almost 20 years beyond Edward Furlong.
Yeah, it's the 30th anniversary of that original Crow film. So despite how they want to say they are calling back to the original graphic novel, that this is coming out on the anniversary of that original film tells me that's what they're really leaning on. They're going to be playing a lot of 90s music in this. They're trying to harken back to that fan base.
Now, I heard a couple things. I mean, you would hear dribbles here and there. I heard it was going to be in some Blade Runner world, and I heard Bradley Cooper, of all people, was going to be the Crow.
Bradley Cooper was one of the people in the lead when it was going to be Juan Carlos Fresnadillo as the director. He's the one who did 28 Weeks Later. Before that, it was going to be Stephen Norrington, who did Blade and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, with Mark Wahlberg in the lead.
Oof, I'm glad that didn't happen.
And then after Bradley Cooper kind of stepped out, they were looking at Channing Tatum, Ryan Gosling, James McAvoy. Alexander Skarsgård was going to be the lead, a relative of the Skarsgård who's starring here. And that one got really close. They were scouting for locations. They had the cast in place, and then Gutierrez had some creative differences, and he went off and did Rings instead.
And Skarsgård did that Tarzan movie nobody liked.
Mm-hmm. And then they were looking at Jack Houston, nephew of Danny Houston, to play Eric.
Boy, they kept it close in this. Like, the relatives of the people that had the job are the ones that are going to be in this. All right. I don't even know who that is, but sure. I mean, it's getting desperate. At this point, they're calling back Edward Furlong, right? They're like, well, can you come back?
Then the company that was doing this, Relativity Media, went bankrupt. They were really going to go ahead with this one, but Relativity Media lost all their money. And then it got picked up and they got really close with a Jason Momoa version.
I remember that name too. I remember, and yeah, they were talking like that was a done deal, and that I thought it had been filmed. So when I was hearing that suddenly Bill Skarsgård was going to be the Crow, I was like, did they shelve the Momoa version next to Batgirl?
Was this like pre-Aquaman Momoa? Or like what stage was Momoa in when they were planning this?
Yeah, this was just in 2018. So he was already Aquaman and he was also going to be the Crow. And then there were creative differences. The person who was going to direct is Corin Hardy, who directed The Nun.
Not excited about any of these directors.
I mean, I would love to see Jason Momoa in a habit playing The Nun. But his version of The Crow. I'm not excited about a new Crow. I just know that it's an inevitable. And it seems to me pretty easy to do. Like, why is it hard not to get some flashy commercial or music video director to put some young guy and do the beats again? I mean, this thing is by the numbers.
Yeah, so finally during COVID, they brought in this Rupert Sanders, who eventually did make it, and he said they started with a page one rewrite. They didn't even look at any of the scripts that had been written in the past decade. None of those ideas got carried forward. Rupert Sanders, I did see his last film, Ghost in the Shell, the ScarJo film that came out of 7 years ago.
Yeah, he seems to be wanting to take projects where the fanboys rip him to pieces.
Yeah, that one was not well received either.
Here's the thing, people hated that movie, but I remember it being like, okay.
It's mediocre, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, it wasn't bad, it wasn't great. It had a good look to it, though. I could see why you'd bring the director back and try to give him another stylish project.
Yeah, he also made some, you know, remember when they were making all these fairy tale live action movies? He made some kind of Snow White movie with Chris Hemsworth or something as the Huntsman.
Yeah, and Kristen Stewart.
Oh, was it her? Okay.
It was like post-Twilight. Yeah, she did a couple Snow White Huntsman movies.
Snow White and the Huntsman. I've heard good things about it.
Okay, yeah, I missed it. But yes, he has some kind of style and notoriety, and God knows they called everybody else in the book, asking him to make Crow.
And he had been working with Bill Skarsgård on a different project that didn't happen, an adaptation of something called The Things They Carried. I don't know what that is. But the two of them liked each other from that failed pre-production, and so the director reached out to Skarsgård and was like, how would you feel about doing The Crow? And Skarsgård had just done another action film. He went straight from shooting Boy Kills World to shooting The Crow.
He's already in shape. He's like, okay, I know how to drink the protein shakes and do the crunches.
But this film was still delayed. I mean, they filmed this in 2022, and then it was supposed to come out in early 2024, and finally came out in August 2024, where you put your best films, like Borderlands, you just save them for August.
Yeah, they couldn't find someone to distribute it. Eventually, Lionsgate snapped it up, and they had it scheduled. Again, we did all the other shows in May, June, because that was when it was supposed to come out, and then last minute loss of confidence. It's because of the hate, right? I don't know much about this movie, except that this Crow has a mullet and face tattoos, and once those images started circling the internet, it seemed like every fanboy came out to throw shade.
And I gotta say, you fanboys are just aging yourselves, because if you have kids, if you don't, go back like 20 years and have kids, or you know, that are like younger millennials, older Zoomers, because mullets are back, people. Pedo stashes are stylish. Tattoos, just random tattoos that are bad and shitty looking all over you. This is the style.
It is. It's totally, if you wanted to have a contemporary take, it looked right to me.
Yeah, this looks like every Twitch streamer that my children watch.
And to me, it reminded me only of Jared Leto's Joker from Suicide Squad.
Sure, yeah, no gold teeth, but close. Same concept, a little Wayne kind of vibe. But here's the thing. You don't want it to look like Brandon Lee, right? The one thing you don't want to do is copy that look, because that is the death knell. If you say we are redoing Brandon Lee, then the hate really would come. So it seems like you lose-lose. If you do Brandon Lee, you're hated. And if you do something that looks nothing like the previous version, you're also getting hate. Maybe people just shouldn't go. If you are so protective of that original vision, you're probably just going to hate whatever they do next.
Well, people didn't go.
I know. I went and there was no one else there.
I went to see this in theaters. There were not that many showings. I had weird times where I could see this. It was either at 6 p.m. on a small screen or at 9 p.m. on the Dolby screen. They were keeping the primetime Dolby screen for Aliens still this weekend. And I went to the 6 o'clock showing. There were maybe a dozen people in there. None were young. I feel like every single one of them went to see The Crow back in 94 and are coming to see this version again.
Yeah, I don't know that it's had... I mean, certainly it's no Batman, right? Like, it doesn't seem that the 1994 movie has the legacy that people recall if you weren't alive for it back in the day. If you were a 90s kid, you know what The Crow is. And if you're a Zoomer, I don't know, it just sounds like a Batman ripoff.
And I don't know how Zoomers would know about this because I saw almost no marketing. I never saw a trailer in a theater. I never saw a trailer show up in my algorithm on social media. I had to go search that out to see anything. You know how LA is, Stuart, with billboards and bus ads and everything. Like, those are major ways to advertise movies out here. Nothing. Nothing out there. Arnie, you say they always double the budget because of marketing. I don't think we have to do that this time. It's just whatever the budget is, that's what they spent. There's no marketing on this thing.
Well, Lionsgate only paid $10 million for this $50 million production, so maybe they doubled their $10 million investment on marketing, but not the budget of the film.
I think they, and this, you're going to laugh, but I think they put all their money in to Borderlands. The money was for that project, and yeah, they had two duds released this month.
I actually feel good that Now Playing is covering the two biggest bombs of the year. I mean, if we can't cover the biggest and best films, let's cover the notorious stinkers.
We never cover the Oscar winners, but yeah, we'll do the Razzie winners.
Yeah, for sure. Well, here's the thing. I'll just be very upfront. I have had a very challenging week, and I have not really been tapped in to... I haven't looked at my phone once. I haven't read any reviews. I went into this thing on Thursday only knowing that I had to get this in, that we were recording this weekend, and that I hadn't liked any Crow movie before. And yes, I walked into a theater that had absolutely no one. It was completely empty. I had a private screening until the last seconds before the movie kicked in, and then two people snuck in, and it was an audience of three. But it seemed to me that, yes, this movie did not have any buzz or excitement around it.
Yeah, I went on a Friday night, and I noticed the same thing as you, Arnie. Like, this was playing at two theaters out here. Each theater was only showing, they were doing like a 3 p.m., a 7, and like a 9. Like, three screenings at each theater went for a brand new movie. Like, yeah, and there was only 12 people there. Like, no one was excited. There was no buzz about this thing.
No, I saw the trailers quite a bit. We've been going to theaters a lot for Now Playing, and even I've gone for other movies like Long Legs. Anytime I was in for a horror film, I got to see the trailer for this and I knew what was coming. But, and I mean, they showed the trailers way back before the June release too. When it was coming out in June, there were trailers. So I felt like I've seen this trailer a lot. But yet, the weekend it's coming out, yeah, absolutely no buzz. You know, the one that's coming out this weekend that I never saw anything for is Blink Twice. I mean, I don't know that they even have a trailer for that movie.
Blink one more time and it'll be gone. But, you know, yeah, we have been anticipating this for quite a while, and audiences have too. Let's get into it. Let's find out what is in 2024's reincarnation, reimagining. What are they calling it? Not remake. I know that's taboo.
New adaptation.
Whatever. Okay. Tell us about the plot again.
Bill Skarsgård is Eric, and FKA Twigs is Shelley. Both are addicts who meet when they go to rehab instead of jail. They fall in love. One day, some men come looking for Shelley, so Eric helps her escape from the facility. The two go back to the city and continue their love affair. But Shelley cannot escape the men after her. These men work for Vincent Rogue, played by Danny Houston. Rogue is a Satanist who's been granted eternal life in exchange for innocent blood. When Rogue whispers in your ear, you perform your darkest impulses. Some people kill themselves, but when Rogue whispered in Shelley's ear, Shelley killed one of her friends. The killing was recorded by Shelley's friend, Dom. Rogue wants to be sure the video is destroyed, which is why the men are after Shelley. They capture Shelley and Eric and kill them both. Shelley is sent to hell, while Eric is sent to a purgatory where he meets Kronos. And I only know that name because it's in the Wikipedia. I don't think his name is ever said in the film.
That's how I learned it.
Kronos tells Eric that as long as his love for Shelley is pure, Eric can come back to life as an unstoppable immortal. If Eric kills those responsible for his and Shelley's death, then Shelley can come back to life too. Eric returns and starts killing all of Rogue's henchmen. But when Eric sees the video of Shelley murdering her friend, Eric starts to doubt Shelley. This taints his love for her, and Eric dies. Eric makes a bargain with Kronos. If Eric can return and finish his mission of vengeance, then he wants Shelley to be restored to life, while Eric's soul will spend eternity in hell. Kronos accepts the bargain, puts black blood on Eric's eyes, and sends him back to the world of the living. Eric shoots, slashes, and maims all of Rogue's henchmen, and even beheads Rogue's right-hand woman, Marion. Eric comes face-to-face with Rogue. Rogue whispers his devil's speak in Eric's ear, but Eric fights it off. Eric throws Rogue into a mirror, which transports them into purgatory, and black skeletons rise from a puddle and suck Rogue down into hell. And then we cut to paramedics reviving Shelley after the attack, and Eric is next to her dead, as credits roll.
As we start, we get very little, but some kind of backstory for our main character. I don't remember reading the comic book or in any other incarnation. This feels created for the movie that as a little boy, he lived at a trailer park with a meth mom.
Yeah, you never got any of this in the comics I read.
This is new backstory inserted here. I don't know if the mom was on meth. I said drunk. You get one shot of the mom. She's laying on the sofa. And that is all the mom we have in this movie. While Eric is outside, and there's a white horse that's caught in barbed wire, and Eric is trying to save the horse, and monologuing about when someone you love dies, you will know emptiness. And I think he's talking about the horse.
So do I. After this film, because the horse is going to show up for like one more frame, and I'm like, I need the Rob Zombie cut. I need more white horse. What is this opening? Because it's a very striking opening. Like, it caught my attention. I'm like, I know this isn't going to be good, but I don't know. This is really interesting imagery. They're going for something here. I can't wait to see how this all plays out. And then it never plays out.
I like it. I'll just go ahead and say it straight up. I like that this is all that we get. I think it's all you really need to know. In the end, here's a kid that's trying to manage the impossible. Sure, we could have more scenes of him attending to meth mom and cooking her drugs and, you know, being the caregiver to people that are in active addiction. But the metaphor is, I'm trying to pull barbed wire off a horse, and I can't save the horse, and it's just leaving me with bloody palms of Christ. He has stigmata. He's suffering the martyr.
And I am also thinking about Rob Zombie in Halloween 2 and how they put the text on the screen of Halloween 2 that the white horse signifies death. And so I took this as a foreshadowing that death will be omnipresent in Eric's life. And yeah, this is our introduction to Eric. This is all a dream sequence. We do get to see Bill Skarsgård in bed, kind of restlessly sleeping while thinking of this. So this is all a dream of adult Eric that is a prologue to the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it explains a lot. I mean, he's a child of addiction. He ends up having his own addictive qualities. But remember, particularly that comic book, there was so much that was in love with goth and poetry and all of this. And this just feels like a poem. The horse that, you know, is dying in front of you can't save it. It's all it needs to be. It tells us everything about the mental state of this character. I like it just as it is.
I'll agree that this is beautifully shot. I really like the shot of the close-up of the horse's eye where you see young boy Eric's reflection in it. There's a visual style here at the beginning that's giving me hope.
Yeah, no, I said it with this opening scene. I'm like, yeah, this is probably going to be a bad movie, but maybe if it could just be weird, surreal imagery with some weird goth Superman killing people, like, maybe that will work for me. Like, I could go vibes-based. I think that's all The Crow is vibe-based. That's why that 90s one kind of worked on me.
Yeah, can I just repeat that? That they don't have a whole lot here. Most of what they have is a vibe, is a mood, is that teenage angsty sentiment. And again, just having one moment. Yeah, you could have had a whole long prologue, but again, just having it be flashes, you're forced to do mental work and infer what this could mean. Later, I think we also see in his dreams that the trailer is burning. So again, I just imagine him cooking a spoon, or mom was trying to make her drugs and burned herself up, right? Like, that's a cliche. We know that story. He lost not only this horse, but he also lost his mom in this destructive environment. And so he is a pained soul.
And the imagery continues with the opening credits that come after this prologue. We get a lot of shots of Bill Skarsgård baptized in blood, coming out of pools of blood. We see his tattoos with blood over him. It's a cool-looking opening.
It reminded me a lot, if you remember David Fincher's Dragon Tattoo opening, where they have the Led Zeppelin cover and all the character all in oil. Like, it's similar, except it's blood. There is a screaming man with lots of tattoos on his body, who I guess is Skarsgård, or at least someone made to look like him, coming out to what sounds like Nine Inch Nails.
But Stuart, one of your complaints about the original Crow was that we didn't really get to see Eric and his love for Shelley. When we started that movie, Eric was dead, Shelley was dead, we got some flashbacks, but you didn't feel that love. That was one of the big things that director Rupert Sanders wanted to correct about this one. He said if he could have had his way, this whole movie would be their love affair, and end with Eric coming back as the Crow, and then the next movie could be all vengeance.
I could tell he wanted to do that, because it's going to be about 40 minutes till we get Crow stuff in this film, and it's like, look, if this was gripping love story stuff, I agree, just give me a movie of this, but we'll discuss it. Sneak peek, that's not my opinion.
Golf clap from me. I thought that's the right choice. It is what I said in the first movie, and yes, I like the fact that we're actually going to know Shelley as a human being. And it, yeah, really starts right here. I would even argue Shelley is a bigger player in this movie than Eric is. Eric has this one moment in a trailer park and then largely is a cipher. She's going to have a whole backstory as being a pianist to a Satanist club. So I feel like it's her movie.
I agree. When we're starting here, we have Shelley's friend Zadie, who's sending Shelley some video that shows something bad happening. It's going to be a mystery what's on the video. We just hear the words, "What did you do to her?" And I think, because I know our bad guy is Danny Houston, who's playing Rogue, I think it's Rogue has killed someone, or Rogue has assaulted someone, something like that. But Zadie says, "We can get him with this. He's not invincible." And Shelley says, "Yes, he is." We're going to find out this video is of Shelley killing someone. I think this video only implicates Shelley. I don't know why Rogue would get in trouble.
I don't know. They're going to be like, "No, but he devil whispered into my ear. Can't you tell from the video?"
Yeah, this is hilarious. They think they have the evidence to bring down this Harvey Weinstein-sized predator that, like, we got him. He's going to jail forever. And yes, what you have is a video of you murdering someone. It's very conclusively going to put you behind bars. Whatever he might have said to you while you were playing the piano seconds before you picked up the knife really seems irrelevant to even me, frankly. And I know that he's using incantations from the Necronomicon. But yes, FKA Twigs. I'm curious if you guys even know who she is. I keep up with British pop music. She was billed to me early on about a decade ago as the next Bjork. And so being a huge Bjork fan, I have dived into her music before. But she's not pop.
No, I only know her because she came out saying that Shia LaBeouf, like, beat her or abused her or something. And I'm like, who is FKA Twigs? What is that name? That makes no sense to me. So, like, I did go on a little bit of a deep dive a few years ago when she made those allegations.
I have no idea who she is. I even had to watch YouTube videos to find out if it's FKA Twigs or Fucka Twigs.
I did look up an interview because I'm like, I wonder if it's pronounced some way or if it's FKA.
I'll give you the short version. Maybe you already saw this. She used to be just Twigs because she's real skinny and she was a dancer. And there was, I guess, some band also called Twigs that sued her. So she's formally known as Twigs. That's what that means.
Oh, okay.
That's what RuPaul was calling her in the interview that I watched, just Twigs.
Yeah, Twigs is what you should probably call her. And she is very twiggy. And I don't know. She's an unusual person. Like Bjork, her music style is unusual. Her vocalization is unusual. She is one of these performers that seems to love jazz, Ella Fitzgerald, as much as she likes trip-hop and electronica. And so you get this kind of edgier style of R&B pop.
Yeah, she's no Lady Raven.
Mm-mm. No, she's not. but same idea.
Yeah, no, but I think she works for for the aesthetic of this film with what they're going for. She seems like an appropriate choice.
Yeah, she's got kind of, I guess my pop comparison would be, she's got the Gaga love for the high art performance art kind of stuff. I think she's a good get, frankly. She works better than if you had a more conventional Nickelodeon star or something.
Yeah, she does fine here. I don't have any problem with any of the performances in this film, really. The three leads, I think, do exactly what is needed for them of the script. And here we get Shelley is nervous. Zadie gets abducted by, we're going to find out, Rogue's right-hand man is this older blonde lady named Marion. And Zadie gets injected in the neck. Shelley goes on the run, bumps into cops, a bunch of drugs fall out of her purse. And so she's actually saved by getting arrested.
It was that intentional? She knew she was being pursued. I almost felt like she did that as a way of getting away from the bad guys chasing her into the subway.
Yeah, it was a confusing moment for me because I'm like, is this about the chase or is this about how she's going to end up in rehab to meet Eric? Like, it plays out really weird. It feels like if it's a chase, you get away. If it's you're getting busted for drugs, like, that's a separate thing. But they, I don't know, just mash them up here.
It's a reason to get her into the rehab that our main character is already in. And yeah, we are going to get a love story. This was like really like a moment of like, huh. I thought for sure, again, because the movies have always been so eager to get to the blood and to the action, I thought for sure that we would never even know anything about Shelley. Or that, you know, it wouldn't even be about Shelley. It would be about this character and who burned up my mom in the trailer. But that we're going to take so much time for the love story is a bold choice that I'm just going to go on record and say is better than anything we've seen in any of the previous Crow movies.
Comparatively, yes.
I'm going to side with what Jacob alluded to before. If this love story really worked for me, then I think this 40 minutes would be well spent. But the time we spend here in rehab, we spend some time with Eric before Shelley gets there. And the way it's edited is confusing. Like, Eric is being backed against a wall by a bunch of people and they're yelling at him. And Eric's exercising in the yard and somebody's yelling at him. And then he's in group therapy. I don't really know what Eric's role in this rehab is other than he's a loner.
I mean, I think you get it. It's called Security Park. This doesn't feel like a loving rehab. And I'll just go ahead and just put it out there. I am now into my second profession. I am a counselor and I have worked in many rehabilitation centers. And this is like a super scary version. Like, this hopefully does not exist. They're shaming him at every given turn. They're like making him wear pink and having people throw him against the wall. And again, the whole idea is really humiliation and degradation. And they keep wanting him to join circles and be a part of it, like they can break him down. Yes, the fact that he remains isolated in his room, writing poetry, drawing, he is going to be the outsider despite the literal pressure to conform and be healed from his drug addiction.
Yeah, I think they're telling us that he is a loner, an outsider. They just tell us a little bit too much. Like, give us a scene and move on. Like, this is a summary for this whole movie. I think there's a lot of good instincts here. And then when it comes to the execution, that's what we're here to discuss. But a lot of the ideas, a lot of the ways they're going to take this script, I actually like. I agree with you, Stuart. The fact that they're going to spend time on this love story is important for this Crow mythology.
I like the love story. I'm just going to go ahead and say, and again, I work in places like this. I see these romances spring up. I think it's very true to life. They call it the 13th step. You fall in love with someone in recovery. That is your way of finding your way to sobriety so often. And yes, fated for doom. I think the challenge is most people watching this are not going to think that this is a pure, undying, amazing love story. They're going to see it for the superficial, just happen to be in the right place, right time kind of convenience that it is. And so does it cheapen the Shelley and Eric story to know that they're just kids that are fucked up on drugs and not true lovers like Romeo and Juliet?
Absolutely it does. This is exactly my problem with it, is what we have are two drug addicts going out on a drug-fueled, ecstasy-filled weekend and not true love that's bringing him back. In fact, the only reason Eric's going to get brought back is because Shelley was influenced by a Satanist, and it's really like a divine influence that somebody wants the Satanist killed, not that his love was so powerful that he's brought back. It really undercuts his emotionality.
I'm of a split mind with this, because for the Crow, it makes sense to have like these junkie lovers that have like the most pure love ever. That's poetry, that's art, that makes sense. But then I'm also kind of like, I can be a grumpy conservative sometimes. I'm like, yeah, but they're just junkies. They're just kids. They're going to end up in jail. But I see what they're going for. And like, again, I want to give the movie that because I feel like that is the aesthetic of the Crow. Like, junkies have the best love and will murder everyone to redeem the other person.
I'm with it. I mean, again, and I realize how controversial this is going to be. If you love the idea that Shelley was this saint, essentially, you know, like that it was this unbreakable bond, and it was so easy to do because we never knew her. She was just a corpse from the moment we saw her in the first one. So, of course, she's just this symbol of purity. No, the truth is, oftentimes young love is foolish and clouded by other things. And, you know, they're going through their own shit. They don't love each other, but it feels like they do because of their addictive personalities. Again, I think it's totally on point. I am totally fascinated that they've chosen to go down this road and show, yes, people that aren't truly star-crossed lovers, but just fucked up and trying to find each other and themselves.
But we're going to cut after Shelley is brought to rehab. We're going to see Rogue. Rogue has some pianist with him, this protege from Vienna.
She seems like a big deal. Can't wait to see how she plays out in this film.
Yeah.
Did it get cut? Did I miss something?
It had to. I feel like a lot of stuff was cut from this movie.
She's not in the end. She's not playing in the opera, right?
I thought that was going to be the reveal, but no.
Okay. I was thinking I needed to see this movie twice to see if I could see her in the background.
Is she in the audience of the opera at the end? There's one person in the audience who stays behind after the rest of the audience flees and looks at Eric in terror, but it's such a quick shot, I couldn't tell if that was the pianist or not. Reflecting on this movie, I think what we're seeing is this is the new Shelley. What we're trying to do is protect her from going down where Shelley went, that eventually Rogue will whisper in her ear and make her kill someone also. But it never really plays out that way. She's in two scenes, and I don't know why.
She needs to be in the climax in order for this to really snap. But I like the idea that right now it's just a tease, and it's a tell. Because Danny Houston is the villain in most anything. I think we know the second he walks on screen that he's some kind of oozing evil. But that he's talking about her being from Vienna, where all the, you know, great musical artists like Mozart are, and how he's been able to see them all. I was like, wait, what year is this? And like, I'm doing the math, and I'm like, oh, okay. It tells you he's immortal before you find out that he's this Satanist character, that he is staying alive in part because he finds pure souls like this talented Vienna pianist and corrupts them, sends them to hell in his place.
And I want to say they've cleaned this up from at least those first two Crow movies where I'm like, why is there like a medicine woman with magic powers and then like a real estate agent? Like, what are these team up here? Yeah, this guy just sold his soul to the devil and has magic powers. Very clean.
Here's the thing. Did I love the Crow? No. But if you're going to retell the Crow, these feel like better tellings of what they were doing. I feel like in every way, what I'm watching is improved from every other incarnation of the Crow.
I disagree there. I like the instinct of bringing in a supernatural evil, which is what they did in the later films earlier.
All of them. Even that first one, they were cutting out eyes and brother and sister were dining on eyes.
But unfortunately, that this guy is just long-lived and whispers in your ear some Satan words and makes you kill yourself, he doesn't seem that dangerous. You know, we see Zadie and she's in this room that's surrounded by clear shower curtains, I think, so that she doesn't get blood on anything.
Yeah, it's plastic. You know, that's what every mob movie, when you walk into the room with the plastic on, you know you're about to be whacked.
Well, this movie has a fetish for having clear or translucent plastic in scenes. And I think it's a symbolism of how Eric and Shelley are going to die. I don't know if the symbolism goes any deeper than that, if how they die also represents something. But yeah, there's a lot of shower curtains and furniture covers and things in this movie that I noticed that are doing this. But yeah, Danny Houston, he doesn't have grand ambitions, right?
Stay alive and send good souls to hell.
Yeah, I guess the ticking clock in this movie is the Vienna pianist that we want to get Danny Houston before he gets the pianist, but the fact that we never see the pianist again doesn't really help.
Yeah, why would you care about her except, I don't know, I don't want innocent people to be hurt, but like, you need more of a reason than that in a film.
Yeah, I imagine this got cut out or reduced. It had to be more. Or in some version of the script, it was more.
Yeah, the director said that test audiences wanted this first 40 minutes to be cut down. They wanted to get to the Crow stuff faster, and he really fought with the studio to keep this stuff in. But I think as part of that cuts, a lot of necessary scenes are gone. If you're going to do this, then you need to do it in a way that's coherent. And I don't feel it is, because we then get a scene with Marion and some woman in a car, and Marion is telling this woman, you and your daughter are very important to us, and I'm like, who is this woman? It takes half the movie for me to realize that the daughter is Shelley, that this is Shelley's mom. I thought she looked too young to be Shelley's mom. I mean, FKA Twigs is in her mid-30s, so... I didn't think this was Shelley's mom. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. They're going to the rehab looking for Shelley. The mom is turning Shelley in, but it has no weight because I don't know who this character is. She's not been introduced before.
I mean, you could argue that's building a mystery. I had the same reaction. What's going on? This movie has an impressionistic editing style that's dreamy and sometimes feels very disjointed and disconnected. Want to just say, also very true about that original Crow movie. And I feel like here, it's at least more intentional. I watched that original movie and I feel like, oh, they weren't able to shoot stuff because Brandon Lee was dead. So it just doesn't have the interstitial. Here, I think, yeah, you're able to piece it together, but it comes later in the film. And do you like having to work that hard for a movie that is, yeah, really simple? At the end of the day, the problem is, there's a video that might expose a Satanist as a Satanist, and so who's got the phone with the video is all that we're really dealing with. But they make it seem like it's way more complicated.
Yeah, I think impressionistic is fine if you do what the original Crow succeeded at, it just being a music video. And I'm just, you know, we got some Joy Division here, we got some Gary Numan, I like that stuff, but it's just not working on that level that original Crow worked for me, where it's just a collage of 90s pop culture put into a music video 2 hours long.
Here's the difference for me. I watched that first movie and it's like they're marketing to us. This is a cool lifestyle. This music, these clothes, this attitude is who you want to be. I watch this movie and I go, oh, how sweet. You guys are so naive. All the things you believe in are totally unsupported and you're just strung out on drugs. And hopefully you'll get clean and then realize that you don't need each other and move on.
You're hoping he doesn't become a Crow in this one.
I'm watching this from the mentality of a middle-aged man going, oh, this is what it is to be young. This is what it is to be naive and to believe we're totally in love with each other and this is forever, when it's just a pathetic couple of days.
And we're going to see in Eric's room, he does a lot of drawings. It looked like James O'Barr art, and that's part of the reason why I did some research, is to see, did O'Barr consult on this? Apparently, he walked away after the Jason Momoa one. He had been involved in so many aborted attempts of the Crow that he's like, I can't put energy into this anymore. And so he had nothing to do with this, but it really did look like O'Barr art on the walls there.
I mean, obviously they're draft. I mean, that's what Skarsgård is playing. I am embodying Obar as the tortured poet who doesn't have music. You know, the reason why she completes the picture is she's the musician. She plays the keyboard. He writes poetry that could be songs. They play together. They might have a hit album or at least an underground mixtape. You're supposed to go with that.
Which I think that's a nice reference to that first Crow where Eric was a musician. It makes more sense. If they're eternal lovers with the strongest love ever, this makes way more sense. Like, one plays the music, one writes the lyrics. Like, I don't know. I like that. Yeah, they fit together more here.
Yes. Yeah. His band was so stupid. And Shelley just seemed like a groupie in that first one that took pictures of him. And now that she's a part of, yeah, cultivating his identity as an artist, as a goth, that she's the one actually that has the cry now, laugh later comedy tragedy tattoo that he will end up getting put on his body.
Some of the stuff that I feel is cut out at the beginning, first of all, there have to be some scenes cut out with this character who we won't even talk about till later named Chance, who isn't a rapper but is a friend of theirs that just comes into the movie out of nowhere.
He's the tattoo artist and seems to have had a role that I agree. He's a Judas, a betrayer or something, but we won't really ever understand in this cut.
And then another character who I feel is cut way the hell down. There's this corrupt cop that works for Rogue, and the cop is at a location where they're pulling Zadie's body from the water, and they're like, oh, this is dangerous for Rogue. They found Zadie's body. Zadie killed herself. I don't know how this is dangerous for Rogue, but it's yet another thing that Rogue has to try to tamp down using this corrupt cop, and the cop's going to get killed later, but I feel like there has to be more setting up to make this cop like a lieutenant of Rogue or a better villain than he ends up being in this final movie.
I think your thesis is, and it's not incorrect, that we have lost the mystery and the action movie because we spend so much time running around a Joy Division and watching these kids make cute eyes at each other and ditch the rehab, that they end up running away and having very long montages of being together. Because we focus on that and the movie is focused on that, we don't get the noir, I guess, the crime story, such as it is. But we get it enough, right? I mean, I guess, is gisting enough? I mean, we understand that this is a corrupt cop that's working for a bad guy who doesn't want a video to come out. That's all that we really need to understand.
Yeah, I mean, the cop, I don't need a whole more backstory on, but I do feel like things were definitely cut. Like, they had a whole satanic cult here working together, and that's going to get pared down. But yeah, they're just going to run off because Marion shows up with some of Rogue's goons at the rehab, and so they're able to just take off their pink sweats and ankle bracelets and run out.
It's kind of weird boundaries because, yeah, men and women aren't supposed to eat together, and yet nobody's stopping these two from having lunch and, you know, long sequences together. I don't know. It's a strange concept for a rehab facility that I'd love to learn more about.
I think my patience wears thin when we get to, I think, Shelley's friend's house and they just try on clothes and do drugs. Like, okay, do a 2-minute montage. Like, this feels like it goes on way too long for me.
Yeah, but there's some stuff set up here. Like, they take a bath together. There's a weird scene where she's like, you stink, but before you shower, fuck me. I'm like, no, shower first.
I mean, that is young love. Ain't gonna lie.
I mean, yeah, it's stinky. Again, I like this stuff. I really like this stuff. I'm shocked at how much I'm actually connecting to this stuff because it isn't the formula, you killed my woman by the 20-minute mark and now I have to kill people scene after scene.
I'm shocked by how much you like this stuff too.
Do you love this because it's different from all those Crow movies you hated? Are you like gripped by this love story? Like, are you really into, like, if this was just a drama about fucked up young love, like, is this enough to satisfy you, what they're giving you in this final cut?
I mean, I like them as much as Sid and Nancy, I mean, who are also a problematic drug addict couple. I think that's what they're going for, right? We haven't reviewed Sid and Nancy. I have my own thoughts about that. They're more complicated, obviously. But what I would say is, yes, I like that it's not the thing that I thought I was going to get that I never wanted. And two, I don't love them in the sense that, oh, I want them to be together forever. It's going to be so hard for Eric without Shelley. But I love the fact that this is the way young love is being betrayed, because I think it's on point. Honestly, it feels very real.
And I get what you're saying. I guess at this point, are you like, oh, I'm recommending this? Because I like the impulses, but I'm kind of bored during it as well.
I am recommending this movie.
Okay.
Holy shit.
Yes. Believe me, no one's more surprised than me. I didn't recommend Alien, but I'm recommending Crow is like the world is upside down.
It really is. But another character that I feel is cut to shit in this edit is a character named Dom. And I only know his name because Zadie says it once at the beginning that Dom had a video that he texted Zadie, that Zadie texted Shelley, as if that's not confusing enough. Dom is going to find Shelley at the club. I initially think Dom is one of Rogue's people because he comes up in a hoodie and he looks kind of dangerous. And he's like, we have to leave town now.
Was he there? Was he the one filming on the phone?
Yes.
So he as the one that actually saw Shelley get up from the piano and go stab the woman.
Yes.
So he would have his own copy, I would think, right?
Yeah, he does. Which is why they're after Dom, too. And Dom just gets out of town. After Eric comes back, he tells Dom, do what we couldn't. Get away. And so I assume Dom did.
Why can't anyone upload? All you got to do is upload it to YouTube and suddenly it doesn't matter. You don't have to kill people because it's already out, right?
Yeah, but they're just going to arrest Shelley because it's her murdering someone.
Yeah, I agree. It does not prove that there is a Satanist immortal living among us sending people to hell in his place. I agree with that.
No. And I think Shelley, she hovers over delete message at the beginning when she gets that video. I thought she might have deleted it, but later on, Eric's going to find the video on her phone, so I guess she didn't.
No, and of course you understand why, because whatever it might prove about Rogue, it also is her moment of shame. There is a moment where she and Eric are, you know, jamming, making music together, and he's like, why don't you play piano? And she's like, I don't do that anymore. And she doesn't want to show him the video. It's a deep source of shame that she has killed somebody. And it would be nice to know who that girl was or why that even happened. Did you guys pick up on motives why Rogue or her would want that person dead?
I don't think Rogue knows exactly what you're going to do when he whispers in your ear. What it says is it takes whatever bad thing is in you and makes it grow until you can't not do that thing. And so when he whispered in Shelley's ear, would Shelley commit suicide? I don't think he knew, but for some reason, deep inside Shelley, she must have hated this woman and goes and kills her.
All I understood was that he had to sacrifice innocent souls to get that immortality. That's his deal with the devil. And so, I don't know, maybe he could proxy kill people, have Shelley do it, and that still counts as him killing an innocent soul. Like, that's the only explanation I could give.
And we kind of get fractures in the relationship between Shelley and Eric, because earlier they're taking a bath together and Eric asks, what's the worst thing you've ever done? And you see Shelley's face kind of flash and then she just says, I ran away from rehab with a degenerate. And we're going to find out that's not true, and that's going to make Eric question his love for Shelley. And Shelley's going to say, if I'm ever hard to love, love me harder. And the whole thing is going to be that Eric questions his love for her. But we're supposed to believe, I think, that this is a great love story, a love for the ages, that Eric loves her so much that it's his love that's going to power his immortality.
I do not, and I don't think the reading has to be that. If you did, I imagine how frustrating this movie would be. But that is not my take on this at all.
I mean, I think the problem is, for people of our generation, you're bringing in at least that 1994 baggage from that original Crow. Like, I know that colored how I saw this because, sorry, producers, I thought of this as a reboot. And so, like, I'm like, oh, they're going to hit those same steps. We're going to have those beats. So maybe that's one reason why I'm calling out issues with the pacing here, because I'm like, yeah, but when are we going to get the Crow stuff? Because this love stuff isn't good enough to make me not want Crow stuff.
And it's not good enough because you don't love them being in love with each other.
I'm fine if they could convince me, but they never convince me they're more than just junkies, that there's something eternal and undying to their love.
It's a fact. I mean, yeah, that's a part of what's going on here. It shouldn't be minimized.
And I like a good romance.
Out of all of us, you're the biggest fan.
Yeah, and I could go with a movie of this if I felt their relationship was strong, if I felt like something was happening here. But the way this is edited, the fact that this is almost a montage of them at a lake and them at a club and them at his apartment playing keyboard, I just don't feel like these actors are given a chance to sell us that they should be together.
I don't want them to. Again, I'm thinking about Sid and Nancy making out as burning trash falls down in the alley. Like, this is a gross love story. There is an element of this that is not to be thought of as idealized. I don't want them to sell that this is purity, because it's not. That's not what they've got here. And, by the way, that whole goth mentality is more about self-injury than it is about loving anybody else. Rimbaud was self-destructive and did kill himself and was on drugs and alcohol. So if you're really capturing the spirit of goth culture, you make it like this. You don't say, oh, she's a holy saint and he's got to do everything to put her on a pedestal.
And I think to your point, that does kind of mesh with some of the elements of that original comic that never, I can't remember being adapted, where the Crow does a lot of self-injury. Like, he's cutting himself all the time in that comic, and you don't see that here, but...
One scene. Where it's one scene, he's holding up a razor blade in his room, and he's thinking about doing something. And I get it. You don't want to sell a movie to kids where they tell you it's cool to cut yourself. You don't want to do it. It's not, by the way. But there is an aesthetic, and this is about a scene where that is about feeling your feelings.
Here's the thing, Stuart. I could agree with you if this wasn't going to become a Crow movie. If it wasn't going to be Eric comes back for vengeance for Shelley, and his mission is to bring Shelley back, and he's going to talk on and on and on about his love for Shelley. If that wasn't where all this was leading, maybe I'd agree with you. However, it is leading to all of that.
Yeah. And it is a weird match. Let's just get to it. So eventually, she decides, let's go hide out in your place, which seems like a really bad idea. And it is, because they're waiting. And I don't know, we get this really graphic death scene. I think the most hard-hitting one we've gotten in a Crow movie, where, yeah, just watching people suffocate with plastic bags over their head, it is nightmarish. And the way that that goon, like, kisses her after she's dead, I don't know, it gave me the creeps.
And much like most Crow films, what we do is see this from Eric's point of view. Eric dies second, so he watches as this goon, he's smiling as he suffocates Shelley with the plastic bag over her head and then kisses her on the cheek. And this is really enraging Eric before Eric himself dies.
So, yes, they've established that these are characters that are united in water, right? Their love spot is this bridge that could be a suicide spot. And then, yeah, they've been in the bathtub together. And now we cut to this underwater moment where she's sinking down into hell and he can't quite swim fast enough to grab her.
When they're on that bridge, did you guys notice the foreshadowing of the Crow? There's like petals in the water in the shape of a crow before he dies.
I saw a pattern. I did not see them being bird-like, but the Crow is minimized. I will just say, if you watch this movie without seeing the title sequence, you wouldn't think it was about a Crow power.
I think the first time you really see the Crows is this. I wrote Crowland like when I was writing my notes by hand during the theater. I don't know if it's purgatory, what it is, but it's a flooded subway station or something with a bunch of crows.
It looks like an abandoned train station that has a lot of puddles.
Yeah, a lot of water, a lot of puddles. It kind of looks like the trailer park that he came from. And there's this factory vibe to it as well. And yeah, crows are just kind of hanging around and murders. And we have this, yeah, French-Canadian guy who is... This was a cut subplot of the original, right? Michael Berryman was going to play some kind of cowboy skeleton thing that sort of helped introduce Eric to the ideas of his powers and what has happened to him.
Yeah, this time they're going with the name Kronos. They're not going with the skeleton cowboy that's in O'Barr's original graphic novel.
Kronos means time, by the way.
Yeah, and is also the name of the head god in Roman mythology. You know, there's all these puddles around this train station, and there is a lot of rain in this movie. I feel like that's a callback to the 1994 film.
They never say the line, though.
They never say the line, but I think it's a callback to it can't rain all the time, that it seems to be raining most of the time in this movie.
Agreed.
And Kronos is going to just read directly from Obar's text. People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead, and yada, yada, yada.
Just in case you thought you walked into the wrong movie and crows playing next door, they finally tell you, yes, this is the thing that you came for. And how that must feel to someone that wanted this, about 50 minutes before. I get it. This is a very weird reinterpretation that emphasizes the doom romanticism and narcissism, and does not play up the violence and the ass-kicking. But I guess that's why we have the second half of the movie.
I don't know about that. We'll talk about it, but that may be the biggest disappointment.
Yeah, I will just say I like the first half better than the second half. What I like about the second half is that they have done what I think that they cut out of the original, which was that there is limits to his crow power, that he actually is going to hurt, that when he actually comes for Marion and gets run over, like his leg snaps and he has to pop it back in place. And he actually is feeling all the pain in his body, even though it will heal and he is immortal, that he's in such torment is so goth, right? That is such a great metaphor for goth.
I love that. They set up rules here that, like you said, that he's going to feel that pain, even though he is invulnerable. Like, it still hurts when he has to heal himself. And that love has to stay pure or else his powers will go away. Like, they set up the rules here. It's very easy to understand. Unlike all those other ones where in the climax we're like, wait, why does he come back to life? What's going on? Like, they never set up rules.
I wrote that down as soon as I hear the line, as long as your love stays pure. I'm like, okay, well, that's going to come back.
That's the conflict, yeah.
But I do struggle understanding the knocking down the bowling pins. You know, we get it in every crow where there's all this gang. There was people there at the murder. And it does feel like the tattoo artist might have been involved. And we're going to go back through all the people and the cop that we don't know his purpose is also, I guess he's a Satanist. There's a Satanist club and all these people are members. And thus they are all guilty in some way of putting Shelley in hell.
And what every previous Crow film did better, including that horrible Edward Furlong one, is set up the bad guys and give us named people who we want to see the crow mow through. And here we don't have that. And what I feel is the inspiration for the second half of the film is that it wants to be a supernatural John Wick film. Because in John Wick, we get all of these stuntmen who come in and do fights against Keanu, and we don't know who they are, but the stunts are so kick-ass, we don't really care.
Yeah, I want to say, I've never seen a John Wick movie, and when he goes to the opera, I'm like, this feels like John Wick. I'm going to bet that they're really inspired by John Wick because John Wick would have a sequence like this.
I mean, we're skipping a lot to get to that opera because that's like the climax.
No, I'm not skipping there. I'm just saying that's where I realized John Wick's influence.
And I feel like that's like the third act. I feel like that's when he's really the crow because he's not crowed out here. And I feel like when he's doing this detective work, it's kind of just, he's like, just goes up and shoots someone. I'm like, I kind of miss Brandon Lee's like giddiness when he's torturing people. This second part is where it kind of loses me because the action's not great till you get to that opera house and it's not a great noir. It's not a great mystery.
No, I do like some of the action. I mean, when Eric finally comes back to life, there's the cop there. He's still looking for the phone. We hear Marion on the phone saying, we are still trying to find that video. And like Stuart said, I like that Eric isn't totally invulnerable. We get kind of a gritty fight here, and Eric gets stabbed in the gut, and his intestine is popping out of his stomach, and he's got to push that intestine back in order for his skin to heal.
More Jesus imagery. I mean, again, you think about the spear in the side, and again, earlier, the barbed wire on the hands and all of that. That he's seeing himself both as this super spiritual figure and doomed to be alone, doomed not to live as a man. I like this. Again, I don't know what else to say. I recognize the second half of this movie is very problematic as an action film and as a mystery. But I do think Bill Skarsgård is easily our best Crow. I think his performance, the way he wears the pain in his eyes, is just so impactful that I can go along with all the sloppiness.
Yeah, there's no debate there. Like, easily the best Crow. Like, I like the design. Sorry, Gen X, I'm going with the Zoomer aesthetic here with the mullet and tattoos.
Yeah, I think he looks cool.
Oh, I actually think that the TV version of the Crow looks better than this. I miss the smiling, crying mask makeup and things like that that Brandon Lee even had in the first one.
You want them to do it?
I do. I think that if you're making a Batman movie, you put him in the cowl with the bat ears, even if you're bringing in a new actor. And I think if you're making a Crow movie, you should go back to that Obar design. I think that's iconic.
They do eventually, but he has to go back to the purgatory and make a new commitment. Right here, I just love the fact that he runs up to the cop thinking, I need help, and the cop just bang, just shoots him right there, and he realizes he's invincible. That much he understands.
So he fights the cop, and then he goes back to that bridge where he has some random vision of Shelley killing herself for reasons. I don't know why that vision happens, and he jumps in after her and goes back to Kronos.
Don't you think that she was a suicidal character? Don't you feel like that was maybe something that was minimized? She took them to that spot on the bridge. That was sort of their place, and there was some talk about, he said, I'll jump if you jump. I feel like the producers got nervous and realized they had a movie that romanticized suicide, but I feel like she was talking about killing herself at that spot. So he returns to the spot to be close to her spirit.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I infer, but it's not in the movie.
I mean, infer is, it's there somewhat if you want it. You have to work for it, and infer means that it's your interpretation.
But this is where Kronos sets up all the rules, and we get that, and then, yeah, Eric comes back to life a second time. It's frustrating to me how many times Eric goes to purgatory and then wakes up in the real world again.
He really doesn't want it. Again, this is somebody that is really fighting to be the Crow. And to hear that the director wanted to make the Crow movie the sequel and never even have the character come around to his destiny, he more or less made that movie. I mean, it really does feel that way.
But during this whole investigation portion of the film where he's like trying to figure out what's going on, Arnie, we finally pay off who that woman is. We finally find out it's Shelley's mom.
Yeah, and I guess she's a danger to Rogue as well. This is where Eric's going to tell her that he can bring Shelley back to life. What Eric is investigating is he doesn't know who to kill. He keeps going person to person and is like, who killed me? Who killed Shelley? What's going on? He thinks that Sophia, Shelley's mom, may know. And we're going to get him going into Shelley's old bedroom where she has a CRT television. I am confused as to the timeline of this. I don't think CRT televisions would have really been part of Shelley's life, but he's going to find photos in her room behind a bureau, and he's going to see that she was actually an employee of Rogue.
Right. He's going to finally get wind of what we've known for, about 50 minutes, that Danny Houston is the evil corporate boss that's also a Satanist.
And Eric isn't really a great investigator. He's going to go to the Rogue building, see the guy who killed him, try to interrogate him, and end up killing the guy. And so Eric keeps killing all of his leads. I kind of like, it's just a little moment, and I'm trying to find things to like in this film because I'm really disinterested, but when Eric shoots the gun in the car, it's like he goes deaf for a minute and all the sound drops out of the movie and becomes very muffled. And then how so much of this movie is glued together is this guy's phone just dings and he gets a text from Marion with an address of where to go. A lot of this movie just happens because Marion is texting people and Eric sees those texts.
And I will just say, it wasn't like the first movie was like a great mystery either. Again, it felt also sloppily put together. But the difference is that you felt like you were watching cool music videos stitched together. And here, I don't know, the music's interesting. Every time I hear a song, I'm like, oh, that's Basement Jaxx. And then I go, wait, no. Basement Jaxx sampled Gary Numan. This is the original Gary Numan. You know, like later I'm like, oh, there's the Fugees. Nope, that's actually Enya. Back when Enya was cool, her first single they play during a scene. So I don't know. The aesthetic is very late 70s, early 80s, goth, new wave kind of vibe. That feels appropriate for the spirit of this movie. I feel like, technically speaking, the movie sounds as it should.
Yeah, I wish it leaned more into that. I went, where's The Cure? I guess The Cure was in that original Crow, but where's Bauhaus? Like, give me that real, like, 70s, 80s goth stuff. Like, they do it a little bit. But here's the thing. Like, yeah, you have this whole fight in an SUV, and I wish it was John Wick. It's not. Like, it's not thrilling me, like, the action here.
This is where I realized this movie's gonna suck balls. Is this fight in the SUV, because I kind of like the idea that the SUV tries to run Eric down and he flies into the SUV's front seat through the windshield because that's how he happens to get hit. But I can't follow this action. I think this director sucks at filming action. I don't know what's going on. I can't follow what Eric is doing. I don't know who he's shooting. The car is still driving. Eventually, someone pushes him out of the car and he gets run over by a semi, but this is shitty action.
I hear what you're saying. I totally agree. And it helps that I don't want this to be an action movie, so I'm not pained by this. The action washes right over me. I agree. It's not memorable in any way. But one thing I know about this movie, you can hate on this director if you want. I think he's doing a pretty good job. I think, just cinematically speaking, most of the scenes here are really well staged. But why the action may suck is the fact that this had an incredibly low budget. I think they only had about $50 million.
That's nothing today.
It goes far in the Czech Republic where they filmed this. That's like $100 million in Atlanta.
No, it's not. It is, yes, they cut costs where they could. These are all process shots. This car was obviously on a sound stage and blue screened, and they weren't able to actually have many car stunts on actual streets. These are the problems that you have when you have $50 million.
But I couldn't even see what was going on in that car. It's just too rapid cut. It feels like Skarsgård can do action. I went and watched Boy Kills World after this because I'm like, is the problem Skarsgård? Is it that he is no Keanu? No, Skarsgård can do action, but this guy doesn't know how to film it. He doesn't know how to show it. It's just too quick cut.
Or wasn't funded.
Yeah, if you have money, you have time for training and choreographers, and they don't have that money here. They just got to shoot it.
This is where money matters, and this is the difference of it. I believe that this director, in lots of the other scenes, is showing he has skill. Why there is nothing to these action scenes is because it wasn't funded to be an action movie. And it doesn't feel like he wants it to be. It feels like that's not the important part to the director.
All I know is we're like an hour into the movie, and that's been the only action we've had. And then Rogue is going to make Sophia kill herself. That's a very obvious scene where he's walking on the street and Sophia's body comes thudding down behind him. But this is where Rogue finds out that Eric has the power to escape death. And he no longer wants Eric killed. He wants Eric captured. But Eric is going to become mortal again. Just over an hour into the movie, that video that was teased in the opening scene, we're finally going to get to see what happened on it and see that Shelley's a murderer.
I like that they made that the mystery. Like, we known that she was sitting at a piano and that something happened because we heard screams, but we didn't see the rest of the video until this moment. But he's, you know, gone through dorm and the old friends and knows that she kept the phone in the wall safe. So, yes, he finally now has the thing that she was hiding from him. Does he fall out of love with her? That was her fear. Her fear was if she showed him the video that he would leave her and then she would kill herself.
I mean, he's going to get shot and not heal. So that tells me he no longer has the Crow powers. His love is not pure.
What Kronos is going to say is the enemy of love is doubt. And so it's not necessarily that he fell immediately out of love with her, but he doubted her.
Doubted what?
His love, because he saw her kill someone? I don't know. I feel, and again, I'm being very judgy here, but I'm like, you go on a bender like they did. Is this really an obstacle to your love?
I agree. I almost feel like, you know, I don't know what he's done. You know, like, it's hard to know, but they feel like outlaws. They feel like Bonnie and Clyde. So the fact that she killed somebody, and supposedly this video shows that it was against her will because Satanism was whispered in her ear, doesn't feel like the thing that destabilized him. There should be something else. I agree.
It is, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. I'll just throw up my hands and say, the fact that he is now not as in love with her, maybe he's just sobering up, right? The pills have worn off.
Yeah, but if he was given this mission because his love was so powerful, and that's what gave him immortality, was his love for her. Again, it was a fling. It wasn't a grand romance.
Again, I celebrate the movie for that reason. That is why I love that.
Except we are told his motivation is eternal love.
Yeah, he believes that he's got someone forever, and now he's realizing, oh, I just went on a bender with a murderess. That feels like you would be less into that. Maybe I should not get involved.
And when you're young, you make mistakes with who you fall in love with. Your hormones are going crazy. You don't have control. You don't have experience. So I like a lot of the ideas and a lot of the things they play with here. I just, that execution just never gels for me.
The movie is falling apart in the second half. You can feel that it's not coming together. Again, the Viennese pianist should be coming back at this point. There are just things that should be being tied up. And instead, you feel this frustration that things are being dropped. And yeah, you can't see the action. It's not adrenalizing and it's not conclusive. And yeah, that he's falling out of love and now is mortal, that he can fall into the bathtub and actually drown and maybe stay dead, except he makes another deal with Kronos.
Yeah, was Chance planning to take a very deep bath when Eric showed up? Why is this bathtub full of water, which I have to assume is cold and stale? There's just certain decisions made in this movie that make no fucking sense if you give it an ounce of thought, but he's going to fall into a full bathtub after getting shot in the chest with a double-barreled shotgun. And yes, this is where he's going to make a deal. It's like a deal with the devil, but it's a deal with God. Kronos says it's not up to him, it's up to somebody else. And yet he's going to cut Eric's hand and cut his own, and they're going to do this blood brother type grip. And he's going to paint black blood on Eric's eyes. And Eric is going to damn his own soul if Shelley can come back to life and if he can get another chance to do this. So again, even though he doubted her, we're supposed to think his love is so pure, he will damn his soul to hell for eternity just to give her a few more years on Earth.
I don't know. I like that. That is true love. Like, I will let you live and sacrifice myself. Like, I actually really like the deal he makes. That sells me that this is a Crow movie.
Yeah, that's what young people believe, right? That's what they need to believe. They need to believe that love is this impossible force. And again, the suicidal characters. I care so little about myself that I'll damn myself for some construct. Not someone that I don't even really know feels very much like a goth aesthetic. My question is Kronos really then Satan? Is this, you know, Robert De Niro and Angel Heart calculating a way to get Danny Houston back into his fold? It feels like that.
I don't know. Why would he want Danny Houston back? He's given him innocent souls. That seems like a thing Satan would like. I don't know. I never saw Kronos as that. He's kind of just this in-between of God and Satan. He's guiding souls from Crowland to the afterlife.
That's what I took him as too, Jacob, is just this avatar for God, because he's trying to get Eric to go to heaven. He's like, you can go to a better place, just let her go and breathe. And so I don't think he's Satan.
I don't know. It could be read that way. I mean, I guess he's definitely presenting that he's trying to offer something, but there's something about the deal that gets made here. Like you said, in blood, the contract that gets made that leads me to believe that this is all about, yeah, you thought you could get away from me, Danny Houston, but I'm going to get you back. And this is my vessel. This is my son I'm sending back to Earth to get you.
But with like 20, 30 minutes left of the film, we finally get the Crow. He finally the makeup. He kind of does have the jester thing. Like that black makeup kind of does make a smile on his face. It's very subtle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the, I mean, you get it enough. I mean, there's mascara on the eyes, the curl of the lipstick and all of that. It isn't a full blown Brandon Lee, and they would be skewered if they tried that. And no actor would want to do that, because all you're going to do is going to be set up for failed comparisons.
Yeah, it's weird what they do here, because in the purgatory land, as I call it, Kronos puts black blood on Eric's eyes. But this is, you know, not reality. When Eric comes back, he's still in that bathtub, and he's going to kill those guys. they killed Chance. They shot him in the head. This was the first moment of shocking violence to me because I thought that was a really bloody shot. And it's all CGI because the director, because of Brandon Lee, he said there's not going to be a single working gun on this set.
Smart move. They should do that on all sets.
Yeah.
So every muzzle flare, everything is CGI. But I thought that was a shocking thing when Chance gets killed. But since Chance is a tattoo artist, we're going to see Eric gives himself a tattoo. He's going to, before his vengeance, he's going to give himself a hand tat and then use the tattoo ink to recreate the black blood streaks on his eye.
Yeah, I mean, kind of cool, right? I mean, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I'll take that as compared to just finding your girlfriend's makeup and using eyeshadow.
I've got no problem with that. The things I have problems with are like, okay, he kills some of Rogue's men here. And luckily, Rogue is like, hey, guys, let's all meet at the opera so he could see that text and know where to go for the climax. Like, it's those stupid things like that that really bug me in this.
It is. And also the fact that when Eric came back to life the very first time and fought the cop, there just happened to be a dagger in a pizza box. I don't know why they kept a dagger in the pizza box, but he's going to use that dagger to fight.
How do you cut your pizza?
Scissors.
But, well, no, there was a gun in a chips bag.
There was also a dagger in a pizza box.
Are they putting like razor blades in their Halloween treats? Is that where this happens?
Yeah, these Satanists, man, don't trust them.
And then we've got Chance just had this sword, and that's going to be Eric's weapon for the rest of the movie. He's going to use some guns, but in trying to be a unique version of John Wick, they're going to go with more swordplay and less gun fu.
Yeah, I like that. Again, is this John Wick? John Wick would do this opera scene, right? When he goes in here and is breaking the kneecaps and stabbing necks and all the things that happen here in the end, I feel like it looks like a modern day action movie aesthetic.
This is where they use their money, not for that SUV fight, for this opera scene. Like, this is where that budget went, and it's good. It's just a shock that this is it. This is your big Crow killing moment. Like, he shot some people earlier, but this is, you know, if you like that first film, this is more of what you want, but it's just contained into this opera house, and it, you know, you get a cool shot, like when he cuts that dude's jaw off, like, awesome. So it's got those moments, but is it enough?
Here's my thing is, you say this is cool modern action. I like the ideas that went into this. Let's have this now become a silent movie. We're not going to have any dialogue for like 15 minutes. We're just going to set this all to the opera that's going on. We're going to have gunshots and sound effects, but we're not going to have any talking. I like some of the things that happen here. Like you said, when Eric stabs that guy in the mouth and cuts off his jaw, when a guy falls down the stairs and Eric steps on his back and you hear the sound of the neck breaking, when Eric gets stabbed through the back with his own sword and then leans forward to use that sword to kill someone.
He hugs a guy to stab him.
Yeah, you guys don't like this? I feel like this is good.
This is great, but I thought this was going to be the movie, and it's just this final climax is when I'm finally getting that Crow stuff that I did enjoy from the 94 film.
Too little, too late.
Yes.
Absolutely. My problem is, I actually wrote in my notes, wait, are we at the climax of the film? You know, it doesn't feel like there was enough build-up to this, and it's just because all Rogue has are nameless, faceless stuntmen who are going to engage in fights. It means nothing. And again, the way it's shot, the way it's edited, prevents me from ever getting excited. I love the John Wick stuff and Atomic Blonde. I love these kind of ruthless, just endless action scenes where the hero is going through it. And again, Boy Kills World, Skarsgård does great action in that. And here, the way it's filmed, I never get excited once. I go, theoretically, cutting that guy's jaw off is cool. The way it's filmed and everything, it just leaves me cold.
Here's my problem is I don't understand the logistics. He's going around stabbing lots of people in a packed opera house, and Marion's like on the phone with Rogue. Oh, he's infiltrated us. He's in here. And like, where's the panic? Where are people like moving around the chess pieces to get it? Like, I think Rogue just leaves when everyone else runs away because Eric shows up and throws two heads into the crowd. Like, where are the cops? It feels weightless. Like, it's very violent and cool and slick looking, but like you said, Arnie, the bad guys are so generic, it just feels like we're going to kill a bunch of Cobra soldiers that all look alike.
I don't feel like I felt any different about any goon in any Crow movie before, but you did have more time to see who each person was. And maybe you got your jollies off out of watching that one go or this one go.
I certainly did in the first two Crow films. When you had those character actors as named villains and we spent some time with them, it made their deaths more fun.
But if fun's what you're going after. Again, I feel like this is not meant to adrenalize. This is not meant to have the audience fist pump and go, woohoo, I love watching all this death. You are supposed to feel the rage of a lover who is trying to fight for his girl to get out of hell, delusionally.
Well, then I should be feeling woohoo, he's avenging his lover, and I don't feel that either.
I feel like when I watch Bill Skarsgård's eyes, I really get it. His satisfaction with each crunch, I really feel like he could have this path. Later in life, if he wants to be a Liam Neeson, he could do these kinds of movies.
And he's going to have the showdown with Marion and let her monologue a little bit before he cuts her head off. And she's going to be like, it started off small and I didn't realize what I was getting into, blah, blah, blah. Just cut her head off. That's what we want. But Rogue, he just gets out of there. That showdown is going to take place at Rogue's mansion, not at the Opera House. And Rogue, it's funny to me. He's sitting there and brushing his hair like Marsha Brady, you know, instead of actually preparing for anything. He's not even worried, really.
And that shows you what a badass he is. He's in league with Satan.
Yeah, he knows what's coming. And again, you're Danny Houston. Physically, you're not going to be able to do too much of the martial arts here. $50 million budget. They got no wires for wire foo. And so, yes, all I got to do is get in your ear and go, woo, 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 and you'll do something bad. But that's it. He's ineffectual. Again, he's the suit. We haven't had a fighter that is of the same rival as Crow in this movie. And I hear that may have been necessary. You might have wanted a henchman that was a badass.
I wanted something that gave a sense of danger or a sense of pathos. I just don't feel there's emotion in these action beats, nor do I feel there's adrenaline in these action beats. And when we get to Rogue, Rogue's going to whisper in his ear, which is all Rogue can do to anyone. And it's like, is this going to make Eric do something evil? What would that even look like? And Eric's going to have some flashbacks and see Shelley and see his horse and see some other stuff.
That horse stands up. I got excited. Like, I'm like, the horse is paying off. It stands up. It's symbolic. He's the horse.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's freeing the thing, the childhood pain. Let's just call it childhood trauma. Mom burning up and horse dying entangled. Yeah, that he is becoming something other than what he has been since getting hooked on drugs.
And so he'll throw Rook into a mirror, kind of a cool visual, and they end up in the purgatory land. And I guess this is some kind of escalation because we can't just have Rook beheaded like everyone else. He's immortal. What would that be? He has to die in this purgatory, being pulled down into hell by black skeletons that writhe like snakes.
Yeah, all the people that he sent in his place, I feel like, are like, nope, you're coming with us. I don't think they get to go free, though. Sucks for them.
We only see Shelley gets to come back.
She's down at the bottom. She's not even really in hell. She's just down at the bottom of the lake. And yeah, she floats up and suddenly she's back in the room where she was suffocated and EMTs have revived her.
And one of those EMTs is the actor who played Kronos. So you could read this entire movie as a dream Shelley has in the brief time she dies before an EMT revives her.
Yeah, Kronos even tells her he fought hard for you.
Yeah, they were making some kind of weird song about death and all of this. And yeah, she's just coming back from an OD. Got the Narcan and he did not. He's going to stay dead, or at least in his purgatory, calculating a way that he can get back to the mortal world.
The director said he looked at literally 30 endings for this movie, and there were arguments with the studio. The studio wanted to leave it a little more open-ended so that there could be a sequel. Spoiler alert, there won't be a sequel. This movie bombed terribly. But the director wanted it to be closed-ended. He wanted this to be a single story and not make you feel like you have to come back to get the whole story. So what we get is a monologue by Eric, who I'm guessing is not in hell because he's like, our love will live on and I know our souls will find each other again. Honestly, this felt like a monologue taken from the TV series. It felt like the opening credits of the TV series. And meanwhile, we see that, I guess, Shelley got off the drugs. She's singing on stage at a club to a small audience.
Yeah, I feel like that's what's transpired, is that this was enough for it to get her clean, and she's going to move on. And he's probably dead in hell, but in the superhero trappings that they've cast this in, it's just all the setup for a sequel. She'll be attacked by some demon in part two, and he'll find a way.
So, Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend 2024's version of The Crow? Jacob.
I didn't hate it. I don't get the hate that it seems to be getting. I'll say that. But whether the arrow is red or green, well, I'll reveal that in a second. But I do feel like there's problems with this. There's definitely problems with this film. Like, pacing. It's weird. The first thought I wrote down as the credits were rolling is, somehow this feels chopped to hell, but also needs to be cut more. The stuff they kept in is not the stuff maybe I necessarily wanted. Part of it's the love story, like it just goes on a little bit too long, but it's also just that second act where he's the crow, but he's not really the violent crow yet. He's, yeah, shooting people and getting clues. That stuff really didn't work for me. But I like the aesthetic. I like the things they tried. I think about one of the underrated Marvel films that I enjoyed and recommended, and that was Ang Lee's The Hulk, which maybe not a great superhero story, but I liked that it really tried to tell a story about child abuse and trying not to pass on that trauma to the next generation. That stuff spoke to me, and I feel like, Stuart, things spoke to you in this where, yeah, I know you don't care about the superhero stuff, and I kind of admire that in this one. Like, I wish they leaned more into, yeah, having this be about young, stupid love and not have to be a crow movie. I do think that is the better version of this. Have this end and then you get the crow in the next film. I don't think that's a wrong instinct. I'll just say that. But as much as my patience was tested with that first act and the love story where it just went on a little bit too long, it really is when they get into the crow stuff where it kind of loses me, where I'm like, I don't know, I kind of just like that giddiness of Brandon Lee. And he just had more fun killing people. And this one, you get the opera scene, which is fun, but not a whole lot other than that. At the end of the day, I wish this was just more of a music video. I think that is The Crow's strength. I enjoyed that film. It's campy. It's cheesy. Sometimes adrenalizing. But it's a nice time capsule. And music video. We talked about that, I think, with every Crow review. Like, just make a good music video. And this, I wish this was a good music video at the end of the day. Just, yeah, make it vibes-based. Make it weird and dreamy and surreal. I get that they're conflicted because there are Crow fans that want this to be that Brandon Lee thing. I don't have that same love for that, so I don't mind if they go off. But at the end of the day, it's kind of a muddled, badly paced film where, yeah, there's things to enjoy. I almost kind of want to recommend it because it's such an underdog, but when credits rolled, I'm like, I wish I would have stayed home. So it's going to be a weaker not recommend, but ultimately a red arrow.
Stuart.
So let me explain my experience. So I'm coming in, I'm watching the last show on Thursday night because I've been through all of this chaos and I'm like, God, I have to fucking go see a Crow movie. I hate those fucking movies. This is so awful. Get to the theater. Nobody's there. I've heard no reviews, nothing. I'm like, yeah, this is a total meaningless thing. Nobody cares about this movie. And then I watch it and go, oh, wow, there's so much here that feels true to life and captures the spirit of goth that the other movie tried to idealize. And this one is just more honest. Like, it's just a more honest portrayal about what being young, naive, stupid. It is like being on drugs. It is like being in a narcotic state and believing that the person you're with is your eternal soulmate, when in fact, you're just both taking speed. I really, really resonated with the story and was impressed that they were able to bend the formula to minimize the action and all of the rage and make it less about that and more about, yeah, just the spirit by which Obar wrote that original comic. It feels the most autobiographical of all of them. So I came out of that screening, I was like, boy, people are going to be happy. I can imagine that anyone didn't enjoy this. Like, believe it or not, that is literally something I wrote down. I'm like, boy, everyone's going to like this one. And then I get home and read it. I'm like, oh, boy, did I. I'm almost like, I need to go see this movie. By the end of it, I'm like, oh, I'm so wrong. Because I've obviously watched one of the worst movies ever made, and I didn't realize it. Because I read all of these horrible reviews. How could I have walked away thinking that was good when it's so obviously destroying the universe? I didn't get a chance to go see it again. I wish I could have. Maybe I am overinflating the quality of this movie.
That's a recommend right there that you wish you saw a Crow movie twice.
Right? I may have had a very distorted, I know I did. I will see this movie again. And I'm sure this movie will be rebooted and remade, and that will be when I will re-experience it. But I actually feel like this is the very definition of underrated. It dared to do something that fans didn't want, and it did it okay. I mean, again, all the problems that have been cited are problems. It's not like I don't see them. But if you are like me and just showing up for the romance and for a drama about the spirit of the Crow and don't really care how well they do the action stuff, which is, I still think, pretty good at the end, you might be surprised at how satisfying this movie actually ends up being. I don't know why everyone hates it. I don't know why I liked it.
Because it's not what they saw when they were children.
Yeah, and I want to end with that. Because again, I mentioned the fact that last week, I was the one that was like, you know what? I'm not going with this Romulus thing. Alien meant so much to me. To see it reduced to something smaller and just kind of generic hurt. I just wasn't on board for it. So I understand if Crow is your movie from childhood, and if it meant something that Brandon Lee died on that set and embodied those values, you may not want anyone fucking with it. This movie fucks with it, without a doubt. It fucks with that legacy, and I can understand for some fans, they're just never going to go with it. But if you're open to a different kind of experience, you might be surprised at how enjoyable the film is. I recommend it.
I think Eric should have been left dead. I think what this movie is a reanimated corpse going through the motions of being human without having a soul. I mean, say what you want about that first movie. It had soul. It had emotion. It wore its heart on its sleeve. It was like a raw nerve of pain and anguish and anger and revenge. I went back and watched that again. It came back to theaters again as a Fathom event. And I got to see The Crow in a packed movie theater. And make sure everything I said in that first Crow review, I stand by it. I feel it even more. I went through a period of intense Crow fandom after we did those first four. I went and got sketches directly from James O'Barr himself. I have Crow art. I got an autograph from Ernie Hudson on my Crow Blu-ray. I really went through a period, and I was listening to that Crow 1 soundtrack and the Crow 2 soundtrack a lot over the summer. And now we have a remake, and it's just so tamped down. And I like Sanders' ideas, his impulse to show us more of the relationship between Shelley and Eric. If you're going to redo the Crow, try to bring us something we've never seen before. But seeing their relationship in real time makes it feel superficial and fleeting, like a fling, not the love of a lifetime. It's two drug addicts having a drug-fueled period of ecstasy. I don't feel like they're soulmates, and yet the movie's going to tell me Eric thinks they are because that's Eric's entire reason to live for the second half of this movie.
Don't you remember being 18?
Yeah, but these guys are in their 30s.
Well, but it is young love. You know what I mean? It's a perfect statement about young love. Everyone else older thinks you're an idiot, and you think this is the love of your life.
Yeah, I'm more and more convinced that this should have ended before they got to the Crow now.
And I like Sanders' idea the villain should be wholly supernatural. That he's Satan's disciple gives reason for Eric to be granted the power of the Crow, although I prefer the conceit that his love is just so strong that that's what brought him back. But Rogue here is just an old man who whispers. It's really not an opponent that exciting to see Eric stand up to. And really, none of the people Eric kills are well-defined. It's an endless stream of nameless stuntmen. It feels like a wannabe John Wick without the great stunts that made John Wick adrenalizing and memorable. I don't hate this film. I just don't feel anything at all for it. It left me completely numb. At no point in the action was I excited. It tried some cool things with the swordplay, but the way it was filmed, edited, and delivered undercut some of the cool ideas and practical effects work. And I think that's where all my problems for this film lie, is in the editing room. The pacing, the way the action is done, the lack of setup for characters, the way characters like Chance just come into the film with no explanation. It's a confusing film that leaves me very cold. Believe it or not, I actually think City of Angels was a more exciting watch than this new film. And that's a damning statement. So this is a solid not recommend. I do think the first two Crow films are better than this, although that original 94 one's the only one you need to watch.
Oh, were we ranking them? Yeah, this is the only one that I care about. And then I thought 4 had some kind of spirit. And then I guess 1, 2, 3. I don't know. Who cares? Those first three are just garbage.
I barely recommended that original Crow. I guess I was more entertained with that one because I'm of the right age. But then this one, I like the prison one. Was that 3 where he gets the electric chair? I think that was 3. And then, I don't know, Dennis Hopper made Wicked Prayer more enjoyable than I think 2.
Yeah, I mean, Wicked Prayer is just like a bad movie that I kind of enjoy Brown Arrow, but I didn't really. Again, I want to remind folks, I didn't recommend it. It is a bad movie.
It was your favorite depiction of the Crow, though, before this one.
It was the best Crow experience I had up until this new movie.
Yeah, for me, the original 4 Crows got progressively worse. It went 1, 2, 3, 4, and then I just had to decide where to shove this Crow remake in. And here's the thing. City of Angels, I gave it 2 stars on Letterboxd. Salvation, I gave it 2 stars on Letterboxd. This film, the remake, I gave it 2 stars on Letterboxd. They're all pretty interchangeable shit for me. But I decided City of Angels, because of the scene in the sex shop and some of the fun action and the good Rob Zombie visuals, you know, the crow flying past the exploding palm trees for some reason. It just was more visually interesting than this one. So I'll say it's better than the 2 that were made direct to video, but not as good as the 2 that were made for theatrical, even though City of Angels never quite made it there.
And that show was at the very bottom, right?
Oh, no, the show is better than this movie.
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on.
I'm done.
No, you only watched the pilot of the show, which was not good. But as the show became more episodic and more action, it was a fine show. It was like The Dead Zone.
Hear what you just said in that. It became more action. I hear very much what you want, and that's not what this new movie is. You're mad because this new movie rejected the action boilerplate formula. I am praising it for that very reason. So that's why we're standing on opposite ends. But that show looked cheap as hell.
It looked like syndicated television from the 90s. I'm not going to damn it for being what it is.
We're saying the same thing.
But I would have gone with this film, even though it wasn't action, if I felt that love story. If I was invested in that relationship, if I gave a shit about the characters, this would be a recommend.
And just, again, to show my hand, having worked for over 2 years in rehab facilities and seen romances like that sprout up all the time and working very intimately and talking to people that are going through them, I probably am just more prone to it.
And again, I think this movie is just technically flawed. The editing is shit. It's a chopped up movie.
I mean, there's nothing you could say about this movie technically you couldn't say about every Crow movie, including this one that you're putting on a pedestal.
And that one I'm putting on a pedestal, I only gave 3.5 stars to. It's not like one of my favorite films of all time.
Yeah, I think it's important to just put it in perspective, however much you might feel about it. Nostalgia in the 90s are playing a role there. It is not great cinema. But we're done for now. Obviously, they're going to reboot this thing. What do you think? 5 years? 4 years?
Oh, I think because this one is bombing so hard that it's going to be at least 10 years before they go again.
No. No one even will remember that this happened. It'll be so easy to reboot. Someone will want to do it. Someone that grew up on the first movie. Some actor will say, please get me this. And it will happen 4 years from now.
When we come back a decade from now and are talking about it, I'll remind you you said that.
Okay. I'll take that bet. Things come back often. And things we think are dead, they never stay dead. Which is why we're talking about The Omen next week.
Oh, yeah. We thought for sure we were safe from that ever coming back. The 666 version was enough. But it did take almost 20 years for that to come back.
Sure enough. Yeah, you're right. You might be right about the timeline, but everything comes back. We're getting a prequel. We all know the story of Damien because the first three movies told his entire life story from birth to death. What do we know about his mother?
She's a dog?
Yeah, well, we're going to go back and see that courtship. I mean, you want to talk about weird romances, a dog and a nun is not something I see too often.
You didn't go to Catholic school.
True.
So if you are a higher level donor, dark child level, then you're getting The Omen next week. If you're a silver level donor, thank you for going on this journey with us. This is the end of the road for you. But if you went higher, in a couple of weeks, we start our gold level donation series with Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yep. We just got to get through Omen and Beetlejuice 2, and then we're getting four. Well, they start as classic movies. I don't know that anyone talks about the Nicole Kidman one being a classic, but a classic movie series we haven't covered. I've always wanted to. Body Snatchers. Yeah, a lot to dig into there. And then four other movies inspired by it.
So thank you again for your support of Now Playing. It's you guys who keep us on the air, allowing us to podcast weekend after weekend, and allowing Stuart to prioritize going and seeing a Crow film during a shit week.
Yeah, I mean, it all worked out, but I'm the one with the recommend. You guys are the ones that are mad. That tells you how bad my week was. It was the best part about it.
So thank you all. Jacob Stuart, thank you for joining me. And we'll be back next week because we can't podcast all the time.
You know, my daddy used to say, every man's got a devil, and you can't rest till you find him.
Thank you for your support of Now Playing.
And don't tell me you owe me one.
I owe you one.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
And once in my life, I wasn't alone.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I don't believe it.
Truth is, belief's not required.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Goddamn creatures in the night, they never learn.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
I shouldn't have seen any of them.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I'm gonna kill them. Every single one of them.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2024, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Buildings burn, people die, but real love is forever.